New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University. Visit their website at cihs.edu. You can now download a free PDF copy or a beautiful printed copy of issue number 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hi, I'm Leanne Whitney, guest host working alongside host Jeffrey Mishlove, co-host Emmy Vadnais, and my other colleagues here at New Thinking Aloud. Today, I'm honored to welcome Rollin McCready to the show. Dr. Rollin McCready is Director of Research of the HeartMath Research Center at the HeartMath Institute. As a psychophysiologist, Dr. McCready's research interests include the physiology of emotion, heart-brain communication, and the global interconnectivity between people and the Earth's energetic systems. Findings from this research have been applied to the development of tools and technology to optimize individual and organizational health, performance, and quality of life. Rollin is the author or co-author of several books, including The Coherent Heart and Heart Intelligence, Connecting with the Heart's Intuitive Guidance for Effective Choices and Solutions. Rollin has been featured in a number of documentary films, including I Am, The Truth, The Power of the Heart, Solar Revolution, Cosmic Sentience, Sacred Journey of the Heart, and The Living Matrix. In this episode, Rollin and I discuss how there is more to our heart than many of us have learned in our society and from our education. The heart has a central role in living a life full of balance and love and goodness and meaning. Rollin is joining me remotely from his office in Northern California, and now I will switch over to the internet interview. Rollin McCready, welcome. Nice to be with you today.
Likewise. Great to be here, Leanne.
Yes, nice to have you here on New Thinking Aloud. I'd like to start actually by introducing HeartMath Institute to our audience. What is the mission of HeartMath Institute?
Well, our official mission statement is to create a kinder, more compassionate world by conducting interconnectivity research and providing heart-based, science-proven tools for raising humanity's baseline consciousness from separation and discord to compassionate care and cooperation.
Wonderful. And now you are the research director for the HeartMath Research Center of the HeartMath Institute. Yeah. And that research, I believe, has a big span from heart rate variability into the intelligence of the heart and, if not, the spiritual heart. But let's start with the heart, you know, as a pump, the heartbeat, heart rate variability. Can you share with us some of that research that you've conducted?
Okay. Do you want to jump right into heart rate variability? Okay. we can certainly do that. So most people know what heart rate is, right? Which is really how many, if you count for a minute, how many times did the heart beat? You know, and then we call that beats per minute, 70 or 80 or whatever it is. But in reality, in a healthy person, our heart rate actually changes with each and every heartbeat. So to determine that, which is called heart rate variability, you measure the time intervals between each consecutive pair of heartbeats. And you find that that time between beats is always changing. That's what we mean by heart rate variability. Okay. So that's natural. And, you know, it's kind of interesting, Leanne, because dial back in medical history, not that many years, it was believed and thought that a sign of good health was a steady heart rate. You know, that the times weren't changing, you know, and these met this completely wrong metaphor that the heart's like a metronome. It's not. In fact, that's one of the worst things you can have. So this variability is natural, this beat-to-beat variability. We have more of it when we're young, and it gets less as we age. In fact, the amount of this natural heart rate variability we have is one of the best indicators of the aging process. You know, and so it's a kind of a linear decline across the aging span. And if the amount of variability we have is declining faster than, you know, the expected age-related decline, that is a really important marker, health marker for future health problems. In fact, lower variability for our age is correlated with every chronic or major disease there is. There's thousands of papers on this now in research studies. But there's a deeper level than just how much. And that's where a lot of our work is. And that is the pattern of the rhythm. And what I mean by that, if you actually plot the beat-to-beat changes in heart rate, you see a graph where heart rate's going up and down on the beat-to-beat, right? And when we, some of our first research into this was way back in the 90s, and we were the first, as far as I know, we published one of our first studies in the American Journal of Cardiology showing that emotions are reflected in the heart rhythm pattern, not just the how much. So when we feel things like anger or anxiety or worry, impatience, the rhythm of the heart is a very chaotic looking pattern, kind of like an earthquake graph. A lot of people have seen those. And so that quite literally, I mean, when I say this, reflects a desynchronization in the activity of the neurons in our brain and within our nervous system. And that's not good, right? We can go into that a little bit more deeper. But back in the early 90s, when we started looking into this, there were very few papers in the research literature, in the published journals, on positive emotions. I think I found three, you know, thousands on anxiety and stress and depression and these types of things. But so we were looking among the first to really say, look at what happens physiologically when we really feel, genuinely feel, I'll call it heartfelt feelings of compassion or love or appreciation, gratitude. And what we found was that not only did the pattern in the rhythm change, but it actually shifted profoundly into a different state, physiologically speaking, that we ended up years later calling heart coherence, as you probably know. And which many, many studies later, over 500 independent studies now show and indicate that that is really our highest functional state, optimal state. So when we learn to be more in that coherent rhythm, we're healthier, we perform better, whatever that might be, whether it's sports or just making decisions or on tests, hitting the target if you're a sportsman, these kind of things. So I know it's kind of a long-winded explanation or answer to your question.
But no, actually, it deserves all that detail for sure, because I think getting into the nuance of either maladaptive strategies, mm-hmm. and I think maybe we could unpack that a little bit more. But what I hear or what I read when I look at your research is the positive affects, if you will, joy, nurturing care, kindness, compassion. They're pointing to a coherent way of living, whereas frustration, anger, in chronic states, right? Obviously, anger has its place. Then we're in an incoherent state. And really, what are these states adapting to? And this might get us right into the intelligence of the heart or the spiritual heart. But yeah, and I don't want to throw too much at you at one time, but yeah, what are they adapting us to, especially when it comes, when we look at, let's just say, people who have distress or trauma in their background, because they're trying to adapt to a very unhealthy family system, but yet there's this other aspect of reality to adapt to that would then bring coherence. So
okay, you're right, there's a lot there in what you just said. Let's start with some basics. And first of all, I think for listeners to understand that the heart sends far more information through the nervous system to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. Now that may sound like some new discovery. It's actually not. This has been known since the late 1800s. A lot of the original neuroanatomy work knew this.
And right, fact, William James, right? Wasn't William James? Yeah.
Well, he was the father of psychology, but based on that understanding, you know, a lot of this was neuroanatomy work when they're really starting to understand the nervous system. But in fact, James and psychology was based on that for many years up until really the 1930s, on that understanding. Now it was all forgotten, suddenly it all became about the brain, and we have to remember hormones hadn't even been discovered yet, so a lot of mistakes kind of got made, I think, in hindsight back then. But let me not get too off track here to what you're asking me about. So the information, and it is information, and in these neural patterns are sent up to the brain, and it goes to every major brain center, the cardiovascular, the heart, the information from the heart. And I'll try and make this a short story if I can here, but I'm gonna go down two different avenues that I think are relevant to your question. So in the 1970s, there were two terms introduced into the scientific lexicon in psychophysiology, and they were called cortical, in the top part of our brain, right, that we get paid to go to work for. Cortical inhibition doesn't work as well, or cortical facilitation. And these two terms were just introduced to describe the effects that the activity of the heart, the heart rhythms, were having on brain function. Okay. Now, at that time, this was a big mystery, and the researchers who introduced that won all kinds of awards later in their life, although they put up with a lot of criticisms in that first, because that was a big hypothesis, because it was saying their hypothesis was that the heart literally is modulating perception. And not only that, they didn't make a big deal about this because it was too far out back then. But the heart often, it's actually in their original data, showed that the heart often knew before the brain what the brain had to do next and sent signals to either facilitate or brain function for its next activity. So it took a lot of researchers, a bunch of years, to unravel the mechanisms. And we were part of that story, I'm proud to say, as well. But not just us. And at the bottom, to make it simple, what they found is on this aspect, and I'm going to come back to the other pathway that I wanted to talk about, is that the neural information coming from the heart, incoherent or coherent, let's just keep it simple because it really does boil down to that, goes directly to the part of the brain called the thalamus, the very core of our brain, has a lot of jobs and roles. All the sensory systems go to the thalamus, and then they get distributed to all the parts of the brain, for example, and sensory gating and so off and so on goes on there. But even more importantly, the thalamus is what's responsible for synchronizing the electrical activity of the entire brain. And you don't have to be a scientist to understand that things have to be in sync to perform well, you know, for the information to flow through and get where it's supposed to go, when it's supposed to get there, and so on. So when we're in an incoherent state, incoherent rhythm, that's going directly to the thalamus, and it basically causes it to inhibit its ability to synchronize the brain globally, hence the term cortical inhibition, although they didn't understand why at the time. And when we're in a coherent state, that signal is also going to the thalamus. It facilitates global synchronization of neural activity above and beyond our normal walking around state. So that's why we recommend shift into coherence before you make an important decision or before you react, right? So a classic example, Leanne, of this is, and I know you've probably never had this experience yourself, but maybe some of the listeners, or you might know people. We get a bit emotionally upset, you know, somebody, you know, ticks us off, and we blurt out something that a minute later we're saying, oh my God, I can't believe I just said that.
Right. You flip your lid, right?
Cortical inhibition, right?
Yeah.
Right. And of course, we would never do it more than once with the same person around the same issue.
Right.
You know, right. So, but you get the point. Because that's, I'm not sure how deep to go here, but I know you were a follower, I think, of Dr. Prebram, Carl Prebram as well.
Yes.
Who was one of my mentors. I have the privilege. He hung out a lot here at HeartMath. Every summer, he'd come visit for a week or two and hang out here. And learned a lot from this. What I know about the brain, really know about, I learned from Dr. Prebram. I have to give credit there. But he's so responsible for so many things. You know, he's the one who coined the term executive functions for the frontal cortex and the holographic perception theory and mapping out the limbic system and on it goes. But what I think one of the most, probably more important things I got from him, two things, and I'll talk about the second in a minute, but was the way we need to think of the brain or the frontal part of the brain, what the ability that it gives us is foresight. That's what, you know, those functions of the prefrontal cortex give us. So the ability to understand how what we do here in the now, in the moment, is going to affect the future. Not a good idea to hit the boss if you want to keep your job, right? you know, but You know, because, you know, our animals don't have that. You know, they have great hindsight memory, but not foresight. And so to keep it really simple, those, that neural machinery, if you will, those structures in the frontal part of our brain that, you know, allow us to discriminate appropriate behavior, set goals, appreciate when we've reached a goal, abstract thinking, these are all part of that foresight. That's, those structures, the neural activity has to be well synchronized to perform optimally. So when we're in that desynchronized or incoherent state, because we got angry at someone or upset or worried, that takes, and we go into that desynchronized state, those are the functions that get taken offline the fastest. That's why we do that dumb thing, right?
Right.
When we're emotionally upset.
Right. Yes, yes. And right. I think you're familiar with the work of Dan Siegel at the Mindsight Institute. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I love his hand model of the brain. It is so rich. And again, that's what you're describing, right? When the limbic system fires and the we flip our lid and we're no longer able to have integration across the brain.
Yeah, I'm adding one thing to that. It's not just the limbic systemic firing. It's actually because our brain's sewn into a desynchronized state, and then we're reduced to responding from the subcortical or limbic type programs.
Yes, I hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas when we're coherent, well, that's all facilitated. So now we have more options become available. We're able to take that pause, if you will, right? Before we hit send on that email we just wrote, you know, that we probably didn't really, shouldn't have sent in hindsight.
Right. So all those systems stay integrated. That would be another way to frame it, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's all integrated. We're a system,
an yes.
integrated system, a whole system. Okay, so that's kind of a brief one pathway. The other pathway that you're really asking me about, I think, is there's also, I mentioned direct neural pathways from the stuff coming up from their neural activity from the heart to all major brain areas. Well, another one that's really direct to your question or comment is the amygdalas. You know, we have one on each side, two amygdalas. And another thing from Carl, Dr. Prebram, that it really made sense was what the job or the role of the amygdala really is. You know, and I have a lot of Carl stories. You know, I'd read some new paper book and, you know, Carl's visiting. Hey, Carl, check this out. And he'd read a page or two and throw it in the trash can. And like, Carl, wait a minute, you know, no. Now he was my student back in 19 so-and-so, and here's where he went wrong. You know, like the amygdala is the fear center or this kind of stuff, drove him crazy. It's just not true. You know, what Carl would suggest is that, and I find it to be quite accurate, is what the amygdala's real job is to determine what is familiar and not familiar. Okay,
right.
So it's... And it's the different parts of the amygdala are doing this. One part is looking at all the internal systems of the body, called interoception. And another part is looking at all the input coming in from the external world, what we see, hear, smell, etc. Right? Familiar, not familiar, in real time. Okay, so to be able to do that, you know, is this familiar or not? It has to have something to compare the now to. And that's what he called the familiar baseline reference. That's formed in the neural architecture. It's stored in, you know, as a type of implicit memory that we don't have conscious access to.
Okay, so we're born with it? No. Okay.
We learn this.
This is laid down in the family of origin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And ongoing as we mature through life, we're always adding new patterns. Okay, so let's take the internal system for a second. Emotions. Another piece of this story is the afferent or the ascending information from the heart goes directly to the amygdalas. In fact, the core nucleus of the amygdala is synchronized to the heart. So every time the heart beats, the cells in the amygdala fire in unison with it. So it's seeing what those heart rhythm patterns are. This is where another piece of the story in our evolution really had the big aha. So if you're having an incoherent rhythm, it looks like anxiety. And anxiety looks different than frustration or anger. They're all specific patterns we now know, okay, in the heart rhythms reflected. That's going directly to the amygdala. So then it's saying, is this familiar or not familiar? Okay. So what happens In fact, there's a quote from Dr. Priebram that I often show if I'm doing presentations from 1969, where he talks about well, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but that the heart is the organ of rhythm, right? And it's what the brain's always seeing is the rhythms from the heart. And it's the main source of creating or establishing the familiar inner reference. So I'll give you a story, a true story from my life. When I was I tell this a lot, I guess, these days, but when I was a little kid, and we'd go to see grandma, go to grandma's house, and one of my grandmothers drove us crazy, Leanne, with her worry. You know, I mean, constant worry, 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 worry. You know, you don't climb the tree, you'll fall out. And just on and on it went. I mean, just, you know. So what I now understand is that she worried enough in the way she grew up in her life that worry had become the familiar baseline. So the brain wants a match between the familiar and the current, right? So you have to worry to feel comfortable if that's your baseline reference. I'm just using worry, but this could be anything.
Sure. Right? Anxiety. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Or in trauma, you shift the baseline very rapidly through a big input to the brain, but more typically it's generated. Baselines are what we repeat often. Right.
With the shutdown state, like a lot of times when people are traumatized, highly distressed in their past, mm-hmm. right, they go into fight or flight very easily, or they also go into freeze state. Be a baseline state?
Yeah, it would if that's become our familiar safety place, right, to shut off, separate from the world. So what Priebram also proved, and this is blow away to me, that this should be common knowledge in psychology, but they're kind of stuck in another model, I think, is that the only way to establish or change a baseline is to change the input from the body, especially the heart, into the amygdala, and do that repeatedly enough till it forms a new baseline. Now, what this means is you cannot think yourself into a new baseline, not directly anyway. Right? It's not the straight line. And without shifting baseline, there's no such thing. It is impossible to have sustained change, right, in our emotional environment.
Right. Or to move from that incoherence to coherence.
Because the brain is going to do everything in its power to get us back to a match.
Right. Because the amygdala is so patterned by the familiar.
Well, the familiar is the pattern, and it's wanting for us to have a match in the now too. That's where we feel safe. That's where we feel comfortable.
Right.
As crazy as that sounds.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Yeah. Right. Now my same grandmother also was an awesome baker. And every time we'd come over, guess what we had? Fresh chocolate chip, warm chocolate chip cookies. A very positive experience. I still can't walk through an airport or something and the chocolate chip cookies and the smell of them and go buy one because of the positive experience I had. It was established early on from that. So it's not just bad stuff. It's just familiar, not familiar. Right.
Right.
Yeah, I give you, there's so many examples of this. And we build new baselines. We don't just have one baseline. We form familiar, not familiar, you know, throughout life. You know, it's kind of our maturing process in a way.
Right. Well, can I have a quick question here? And you might be able to tell us like the quick coherence technique or, you know, one of the quick techniques, because you have a lot of techniques at HeartMath. But when we do the work to get in touch with the heart and the rhythm and with breath or attention into the heart, are we creating a new baseline? It's hard for me to articulate this. In, let's say, Euro-American language, it's easier for me to articulate it. I'm a long-term yogi. I have practiced and studied yoga for a long time. And in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, in the third chapter in particular, there's two sutras, 333 and 334, depending on the translation. And 333 is all else by intuition. It's Vibhutipada. It's the chapter where he's talking about basically psychic abilities or the ability to, you know, see with the third eye, hear clairaudience, clairvoyance. He'll say all else by intuition. And then in 334, he says, by concentration, meditation, and absorption into the heart center, we come to know the mind. So like, is there a universal baseline towards a coherence? Or is that too much of an ungrounded question to ask?
Made me take my science hat off for a bit here. But before I do that, I can say that, in fact, a PhD dissertation study many years ago looked at kids across the age span in different types of school environments, asking the question, are they naturally coherent or not? And they are. And with each year, it got less in certain school environments, public schools, actually, and in other types of schools. I can't remember now. It wasn't Montessori, but one of those kind of schools, they actually were building it more. So we're naturally wired. We come into the world to be coherent and connected to our deeper heart, from my perspective. We even have electrophysiological data showing that. That's part of your question. Okay, so the way we establish, I'm going to finish baseline, and we'll jump to, I think, what you were asking between the lines or saying between the lines there. So what Prebrum showed, and we've seen this, we actually can measure this now. When we use a technique like, say, heart lock-in, especially, where it's more of a heart-focused meditation, where you really shift into that coherent state, starts with heart-focused breathing, but that if breathing techniques were all we needed, the world wouldn't be the way it is, right? Then we add a regenerative emotion like appreciation or care or compassion to really breathe that feeling and then lock that feeling in and sustain it. So the heart lock-in is more like a, out of all of our techniques, it's the only kind of meditation technique. And most of it focuses on in the moment, shift to coherence when you're in the traffic jams and meetings and things like that. But so that's where you would sit in that coherent state for however long you people usually grow in their length of time, maybe a couple minutes to 5 minutes to 10 or 15. So what are you doing? You're sitting there in coherence. That's the rhythm that's now going to the amygdala, right, for longer periods of time, while we're actually consciously, radiating love or compassion or appreciation or gratitude or kindness, these types of things. So that's reinforcing what we're naturally wired to be. So sitting in that state long enough, and if you do that a few days a week, you're starting to reprogram the amygdala's baseline. It's a straight line, rapid way to do it. Now you've established that new baseline. That becomes the new familiar that the brain wants to match to. So getting incoherent starts to feel uncomfortable versus getting coherent feeling uncomfortable. That makes sense?
Oh, it's making complete sense. And I think you're going to say from the coherence, then the intuition or then those.
Exactly. That's part two. Okay. So, in fact, we've actually shown that in some pretty rigorous studies. And so we did a couple of years of when I first published this in peer-reviewed scientific journals, it was called The Electrophysiology of Intuition. And we went down that route because so many of the people practicing the coherence techniques, and this still to this day, we hear this, God, my intuition's on steroids. This is different. And then part two is usually, and then synchronicities, they become a way of life. It's not certainly true for me. So we heard that so much. We've said, okay, we've got to see how do we bring this into the lab. And this is kind of complex, but it's all published for people that want all the gory details. But basically, we developed several different protocols. But the first one was pretty easy to understand. A person sitting at a computer and you push a button and we record all the data, EEG, the brain waves and the heart and skin conductance, these types of things. And then after a few seconds, the computer randomly selects an image that it shows on the screen, a picture. And these are photographs that are already been well researched to evoke certain types of emotions and the intensity of the emotions. So we use kind of the extreme opposite ends of the international affective picture sets. You probably know it. It's what it's called. So the really, I'll call them yucky ones to use a scientific term here, like a snake striking at the screen or, really edgy stuff, a bad guy with a knife at a woman's throat or just, pretty edgy. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got bunny rabbits and nature scenes and things like that. Okay. But this is done in such a way that you cannot possibly predict the future picture. In fact, the computer doesn't even know. I mean, it's truly randomly selected after the data's been collected. Okay. So, What we found, it even surprised me, because we were really asking the question, can we really trace when, where, and how does this intuitive information, where does it show up at, and how does it flow through, you know, the heart, mind, brain system? And all we found was heart first. The heart would shift at rhythms. The heart sent a measurably, and this is a key thing, different neural signal to the brain. That's a technique called heartbeat evoked potential analysis, where you see how the brain responds to the ascending information from the heart. You can actually trace it both in time and location through the brain. So the heart first sends a major different signal to the brain. Then you have a brain response, then a body response, all before you see the picture. So the gut gets the credit, right? Or the hair on the back of the neck, because that's where we feel it. And that's because of the change in the efferent or the ascending stuff to where it becomes conscious feeling, if you're paying attention, right?
Wait, that's efferent or afferent? That's the ascending or the descending?
Heart, afferent, which is ascending.
Going up, yep.
Neural changes, amygdala mismatch, whatever, or match. Then you're changing the efferent or descending to the body where the gut feeling or the hair or the back of the neck or the feeling of dread or whatever that might manifest as. So it was heart, brain, body, then conscious if you're paying attention. So the heart was getting the information first. And then we did this experiment with about 30, in the first round of this, 30 people, twice, once in a normal state. We were nice to them, you know, wire them up, you know, okay, well, now do the protocol, which took some time. And then on the second time, they shifted it, you did the heart lock-in technique for a few minutes to shift into coherence first. And a dramatically different finding in terms of that afferent or ascending channel between the heart and brain right to the frontal cortex. In fact, that study showed that we would probably have to redraw the anatomy maps because the frontal cortex was getting the signal first, even before the brainstem, and then rolling backwards across the brain. Then later came a backwards to front signal. And then since then, that neural circuit direct from the cardiovascular system to the frontal cortex has actually been mapped out since that study even. That's a different track. But so in other words, you know, the way I got that published at that time, this would have been what, late 90s, was to say the heart appears to have access to a field of information outside the boundaries of time and space. Okay. Perfectly acceptable language at that time, you know, for peer reviewed scientific journals, because, you know, entanglement and non-locality had been experimentally proven and all this at that point. This was kind of the topic of the day. But at that time, it was only supposed to happen at subatomic scales. You know, that's been blown way past now in quantum physics, you know, macroscopic objects, entanglement and these types of things. We were just showing it in the heart kind of before that. And so this kind of gets to the spiritual element you were hinting at, because that was my code back then for what I'm a little more out of the closet these days. Well, what is a field of information outside the boundaries of time and space? Well, I call it the energetic heart or the spiritual heart, what I'm suggesting, Leanne, is that the energetic heart is a real thing. It's a real structure. It's just we're multidimensional beings. So that it just exists in a different dimension of density, but very complex. And the energetic heart, from my perspective, is what's in communication with the DNA and all the cells. It's where the real blueprint for who we are is.
Beautiful. Well, yoga would agree with you. I'll tell you.
Yeah. I mean, at the physical DNA, you've got eye color and male, female, that stuff. But who we really are is not in the DNA. In fact, that was one of the big surprises, you know, however many years ago, the mapping the human genome, way too few codings to explain life and coding. Where's the missing information? Right. So, anyway, so what I'm saying is that the energetic heart is quite literally the bridge to what you can call your higher self. We just call it your larger self here at HeartMath to take it out of spirituality, religiosity, and that kind of thing. But your soul, your spirit, whatever you want to call it, it's part of our multidimensionalness. And so the energetic heart is that bridge between that higher vibrational part of ourself and, you know, our 3D human day-to-day humanness.
Beautiful, beautiful. So you've talked about Carl Brbrum, and of course, he had a relationship with David Bohm. wholeness in the implicate order. And David would talk about the implicate explicate. Tell me how your work also kind of coincides with that, because I'm hearing touches of that as you.
It's different language. I'm a Bohmian fan. I never got to meet David. Unfortunately, he passed away before I had the opportunity to meet him. But I did meet his main collaborator, Basil Hiley, who actually came here for a conference we held on quantum physics and brain function that Carl was kind of the mastermind of. And so I got to know a little bit about him through Basil. And the implicate order, I think, Basil's, it was really interesting sitting around with, Roger Penrose was here for that meeting and a bunch of people I won't even remember now. But it struck me at that time, this is quite a few years ago, this would have been somewhere in the 90s, that, the Roger Penrose and Basil Hiley and the Prebrams of the world, the discussion we've been having, they're like, well, of course it's that way. Right. I have absolutely no problem with thinking about that. We have, larger selves and the implicate order.
Right. Sure.
His code word. Right. Mine was, information not bound by time and space. He called it the implicate order. Same thing. And it was really interesting to see that the really great pioneers in physics, quantum physics or physiology, they're not limited by this small boxed in thinking that so many scientists are in. I don't know if that makes sense to you or not, but
It's how we ask questions. I mean, science is an amazing tool, right?
Yeah,
not like we want to get rid of it, but we do want to be able to have a big enough playground to ask questions that can get to the heart, quite literally.
It struck me though of how open they were and how deep their thinkings were about the nature of consciousness and things. I'll tell you, you might appreciate this, because you knew Carl's work when we first did the. Intuition research I was just talking about, because we were also looking at cortical evoked potentials and a bunch of other things. It was a very complex study. So I called Carl up and sent him my data and said, Carl, I need your help on, he invented a lot of the evoked potential stuff and how to interpret them. I miss him, having him to go to these days from some of this stuff. Carl, how do I interpret this? Some of the cortical evoked potential stuff we were also seeing. And, he was very helpful, but he told me, he says, Roland, I'm very upset by your data. Carl, why, Carl? And he said, well, it doesn't fit my paradigm. Okay. But backhanded comment, but I have to pay attention to it. Because he actually had been here enough. He knew we pretty rigorous in what we did. Well, it's the part two of the story. About 2 weeks later, he literally calls me and says, Roland, when you come back to, Georgetown, I think, and you've got to help me present. I'm having this argument with a quantum physics group here, and your data is exactly what I need to prove my point. But, well, Carl, I thought you were upset. No, I changed my paradigm.
What was the research? What was it?
Well, this was the intuition research, where we saw the heart before the brain.
Okay.
That stuff. That was because I was getting his help on some of the interpretations of some of the cortical evoked potential. But it was just an example of how someone of that stature would, within a week or two, integrate new data into their paradigm.
Yes. Beautiful. And also, I love Carl too. I'm a depth psychologist by degree, and Carl was a fan of Freud's project for scientific psychology. He didn't think it should be left on the shelf, that we could keep moving forward with that. And I would say heart math is moving in those directions. But to go back to Bohm for a second, the implicate explicate, you also do research on global coherence. We've talked about heart rate variability, coherence between the heart and the brain. But then there's also this element, yes, of synchronicity, but also quite literally syncing up with the earth and with each other. Now, whether you want to call that the grand explicate order, maybe tell us a little bit more about, I know you took over from Princeton University there, that research. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Sure. I'd be happy to. Can I back up one or two steps to tell the story of how we got there? So we had a lot of fun in the 90s, I have to admit, but we were, I didn't care about publishing and was just more in the lab doing stuff. But what we, my help give a little more context here. My previous career was a communication engineer. I used to work for Motorola. So I was a professional at using electromagnetic fields to carry information around the world. So this is before cell phones when I was there, but right in that transitional area of that. So when we put electrodes on the body to measure the electrocardiogram, or the head, the brain, your brain waves, the electroencephalograph, it's called the electro because we're measuring electricity, literally, right? So what the electrodes see is the flow of current flowing generated by the beating heart or the squiggly lines in an EEG of the neural structures in the brain. What the physics 101, we know when you have a flow of current, you create a magnetic field, right? Now, electrodes don't see that. You have to have a different instrument, and that's called a magnetometer. So one of the qualities of magnetic fields is they go through things. That's why cell phones work indoors. Right? I mean, you can be in an elevator and your cell phone works, right? Because it's the magnetic components that's going through the windows and the walls and so on to carry that information from your phone to the cell tower. So I am of the perspective that most of what we invent in technology, nature beat us to, already invented. Because we are working the same way. So every time the heart beats or the brain waves, we are radiating magnetic fields. And how do I know this? Because I can put a probe out here called a magnetometer and measure it. Right? This is not some theory.
Right.
In fact, most major hospitals have what are called MCG, magnetocardiograms, where you don't have to touch the body. You measure the fields of the heart externally or the brain.
Right. It's like 3 feet out or something, right?
You can back up the sensors to about 3 feet.
Yeah.
Until you lose signal from the heart. You can back it up about an inch until you lose it from the brain. So clearly the heart, energetically speaking, is by far the big energetic player. So what we did, said, okay, we'll record the magnetic field and can we decode the information being carried by that field? And, you know, it's very easy because it's the same thing I used to do at Motorola, we could. And I was really surprised to find that nobody had ever done that before, never asked that question. It was actually not that hard. Using standard Fourier processes, so we could clearly see that the heart's magnetic field is carrying the information about what we're feeling. And it actually has a correlation, mathematical correlation, back to the HRV patterns. Incoherent, we are also radiating incoherent structured information patterns. Coherent, a very nice coherent signal that we're broadcasting. So part one of the story that to get to where you're asking is what we feel inside doesn't stop at the skin. We are literally broadcasting and radiating our emotions. Now we can measure it to 3 feet, but that the field goes farther. That's the sensitivity of the instrument. And we've done experiments that prove that, you know. Then part next step in that line of research was asking the question, okay, we know we're radiating, broadcasting. Is our nervous system also acting like an antenna and receiving the information in a measurable way? And yes, make a long story short, you can measure physiological responses. So then that led to a whole bunch of experiments that show that there really is an energetic level communication that's always going on between people. I mean, of course, we've got body language and tone of voice, but there's another, often even maybe more important, unconscious for most people, communication going on. Right. So this has a lot to do with quality of communication and, you know, people feeling heard and okay, I won't go into the depths here. So the next step in that line of research was, well, okay, are we able to synchronize with each other? And the answer to that is yes, when we're coherent and especially if you have a positive emotional connection. So that's another whole kind of group of research studies we've done and are still doing. Then the next step was, well, okay, globally, which is where you asked. I just wanted to give the connecting dots, yeah. Otherwise it would sound out and what. So this started, I don't know, I'm horrible with past time references, at least 15 years ago with what we started what's called the Global Coherence Initiative to really look at the energetic interconnectivity between us, each other, and the Earth itself. And that may sound like a stretch, but not when you consider that the Earth has, we all live in the magnetic fields of the Earth, right? So we started what's called the Global Coherence Monitoring System. which are ultra-sensitive magnetometers specifically designed to measure the what are technically called resonant frequencies, the vibrating fields in the Earth's magnetic fields that we all live in. Right, so we know we have the North Pole and the South Pole, right, the magnetic field. And that's, thank God Earth has this magnetic field, because it's what protects Earth from solar wind and all that. Without the Earth's magnetic field, Earth would turn into Mars very quickly. Be no atmosphere, no water, but all just get blown away without that field. But here's the thing, Leon. I didn't even know that. I actually learned this much later after we created the monitoring system and started seeing that there are these kind of very complex spectrum of frequencies. Because, you know, the Earth's magnetic field is a static field. It's like a magnet you stick on your refrigerator, right? It's not supposed to be vibrating. It's a static field. But here's the thing. You can pluck magnetic field lines, and they vibrate like guitar strings. And what's plucking the strings of Earth is the solar wind coming by, that Earth turning in. And it's plucking the strings. And it's been known forever, long before I came along, that there's a name already well established called field line resonances. Okay. But nobody had ever connected the dots before. So it turns out the primary resonant frequency of Earth's magnetic field lines vibrating is, in frequency language, 0.1 hertz. So what was like astounding, like when we saw this, was that's exactly the same frequency as the human heart rhythm when we're in a coherent state. 0.1 hertz. It's the center of the bell curve for humanity's inner resonant frequency. Okay. So this is kind of, wow.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. The body of the human aligned with the body of the mother, so to speak.
Well, right. And then there's a second set of magnetic waves that are a completely different mechanism that New Age is kind of onto these days a little bit, called Schumann resonances. And this has nothing to do with the field line resonances. These are magnetic waves bouncing between the Earth and the bottom of the ionosphere. And if they fit the geometry, they reinforce each other and become, well, technically they're called globally propagating standing waves. Just means they're everywhere all the time. Okay. And as it turns out, there's eight of them, and they exactly overlap our brain waves. Now, magnetically speaking, the strength of the Schumann resonance is tiny compared to the field line resonances. Now, it's very similar. Now, who knows if this means anything, but probably does. If you look at the ratio, like the heart, remember I said the heart, you can measure 3 feet away, you can measure a brainwave an inch away?
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it's the same scale at Earth. The field line resonances are many orders magnitude stronger than the Schumann resonances. So our physiology is mirroring the same frequency ratios as Earth in terms of these frequencies. So anyway, through basic resonance principles, you know, tuning forks that vibrate, you know, we have the basic physics for understanding how oscillatory systems at the same frequency transfer energy and information between them. So I don't think it's that big of a jump to understand how the information being carried by the Earth's fields can interact with and through resonance principles us, right, and us with them. Right.
Right.
So with GCP2, I mean, we know we're affected by the fields of the Earth. There's no question of that. There's hundreds of studies showing that. It's a little bit of a stretch here for some to say, well, wait a minute, it's a two-way street. We're also, through resonance principles, coupled to the field. So what we're thinking and feel, especially feeling, is also feeding information coupled into the field that's being distributed globally. So I call it the global information field that we're all contributing to all the time. I'm not the first to propose this. You know, Chardin proposed it. Carl Jung proposed it in his own way. I mean, not scientifically, you know, and so on. But basically, that's the essence of how the global coherence initiative started. And now I'm suggesting that these fields interconnect all living systems and share information across them, not just humans, trees, animals, plants, you know, whales. You know.
Right. Right.
Bunny rabbits are all interconnected through this field. So then the next set of tools I like to think of in our toolbox for measuring global interconnectivity was a tree, what we call the Global Tree Rhythm Project. And that's where we're monitoring. It's the first time. This is really basic research. So we're putting trees all around the world are now being monitored because that gave us a living system, right? So trees are awesome participants because they don't run away. They stay put. and they don't mind if we put a couple of electrodes in them. So trees, as it turns out, are very dynamic electrical lives as well. They have circadian rhythms and so on. So that's another set of tools. Then the most current instrument is what you're referring to, which is started at Princeton by Roger Nilsson, the Global Consciousness Project. And so he approached us a few years back, me actually, and asked if HeartMath, we would become the new home for it. So we are, and we've completely redesigned it from the ground up. I mean, new devices, new infrastructure. So this is for those that aren't familiar with it, I think of it as a globally distributed scientific instrument that are basically random number generators. And you could say, well, what the heck does a random number generator have to do with consciousness? And to connect that dot, so back at Princeton at the Paralab, it was called, they had a lot of fun too. They were doing a lot of experiments around the question of, can human consciousness affect the physical world? So they did a lot of cool things.
Right. I think, is it the Princess Diana research from there?
I'm going to get to that. Okay. Yes. So, well, and they did if you look at the data, they showed, yes, our consciousness can in subtle ways interact with and influence physical outcomes. But one of the tools they got onto of using was random number generators. And the way to think of a random number generator is as an electronic coin flipper, right? If we know if we flip a coin, 100 times, you're going to, on average, come up with 50 heads, 50 tails. But you might have a string of 8, 10 heads in a row or tails or repeating sequences that don't look like they're random, but even though they are, if you look at a large enough scale. So they were doing experiments that asked questions like, well, can people intentionally bias or change the output of these devices, above and beyond, random expectation? And yes, they found they could. So somehow people were interacting with these physical electronic devices and changing their behavior. So then Roger Nilsson got the idea, well, what if we have multiple of these devices and see what happens? And the first, they had a small network, and Princess Diana was actually the first event they looked at, big global event, and found, wow, sure enough, the behavior of the devices changed.
When she passed away, this was on her death, yeah. Right? Death.
Yeah. So that then led to the Global Consciousness Project with devices all around the world. And 20 some years later, in hundreds of events being formally analyzed, the statistics now on from GCP1, as we now kind of lovingly refer to it, because GCP2 is now the new version and everything, were over 1 trillion to 1 odds against chance.
Wow.
That this is measuring a real effect. So
highly significant.
Highly, highly, highly significant. You don't get much better than that.
Right.
7 sigma, right? So many types of events have been looked at, tragedies or global celebrations, global meditations, Earth Days, things like this. And my favorite study that Roger did, Dr. Nilsson, I should say, is when he had 500 formal events, and formal just meaning they were pre-registered of what the event was going to be and how we're going to analyze it. And he published results no matter what and that kind of thing. That's where that 1 trillion to 1 statistics comes from. But he rated them with their level of love and compassion. That was the metric. So like World Peace Days or globally organized large-scale meditations for world peace or these types of things, high love and compassion. Then in the middle category were things that to back up a little bit here. What's very clear from this network is that it's the things that evoke emotion that moves the dial. Mind intention doesn't do so much on the global field. So on the global level. So the middle category was things like Super Bowls, World Cups, a lot of emotion, but not necessarily a lot of love and compassion going on, And then the low category, low love and compassion, was things like terrorist attacks and earthquakes and things like that that evoke, a different. And what he found, what he showed was that the events high love and compassion have a significantly greater impact on creating higher network coherence among the devices. Now, there's a a significant point that I want to make here that emerges when you look at a network of devices instead of just one where you're trying to make more heads or tails or ones or zeros. And it's not in the net at the global network level. It's not that you're changing the overall random output to be more ones or zeros. What is actually happening is these devices, even though they can be thousands of miles apart, hundreds, thousands of miles apart, start flipping ones or zeros at the same time in a correlated way. So that's the effect at the network level. And so the metaphor we've been using is to think of this as like buoys on an ocean, right? You've got choppy seas, they're all over the place, no correlation, or you've got coherent waves where they're going up and down at the same time. Now, as it's turning out, some of the newer analysis, we got some really smart people that have joined our research team now, is that may not be a metaphor. It may very well be accurate to start thinking of the global consciousness field as a field with these waves going through it. And so one of our new hypotheses in GCP2 that you couldn't have asked in GCP1 in the same way, but is, well, in GCP1, it's clear that there's a correlation between the number of people involved in the event, you know, usually media, you know, large scale media events and the risk, the effect size. But in GCP2, we're asking a new question, and that is, can a much smaller group who are of highly coherent people with a shared focus, can they have as large or maybe even larger effects on creating coherence in the global consciousness field? And so we're just getting started, and we have a couple of really clear examples where the answer to that is probably yes.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of the 100th monkey principle or the butterfly effect or something to that degree. And often when I think of your research and the heart and reaching out, I think of Ramana Maharishi, because he often talked about, you know, silence and just getting into that stillness and then pointing right into that heart center. And he certainly affected thousands of people, and his work still continues to teach many.
Yeah, they did some great studies, and they're still doing some work like that, I think, to show that, you know, people meditating regularly can reduce violence and crime statistics and these types of things.
Wonderful. It's a frontier for sure. But also, well, I think pointing back to, again, what the sages and the yogis and the mystics have pointed to for a long period of time. So we're coming at it from a different angle, but also, if you could say, syncing up with information that's come through various means hundreds and thousands of years ago.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I hear most from people in the non-scientific community is, thank you for validating what I believed or thought was true.
Right, right. Exactly.
Intuition and interconnectivity. And then they often will say, it's given me more security and confidence to practice what I already thought was the right thing to be doing. You know?
100%. And I know we're, you know, getting close to the end for our time today. Is there any key pointers that you would like to leave the New Thinking Aloud audience with today?
Well, it's time for new thinking. I mean, I love the title of your show. And to really go to new thinking, though, I think the evolution of consciousness is really the journey we're all on together as humanity. And the next shift is, from my perspective, to heart-based, where the heart and mind are more integrated, and to where we are able to access that higher dimensional intelligence, what we call heart intelligence, that we were talking about earlier. And one of the ways that I think that, in a very practical thing we can do as we go throughout the day, as often as we can remember to, just take a pause and ask yourself, what am I feeding the field? Right? The field that's affecting all of my cells and the environment and even globally. Am I feeding the field love, compassion, kindness, care?
Right, right.
Or am I feeding the field, you know, frustration, impatience, you know, anxiety? Because it matters.
It matters. The positive affects are coding for one set of circumstances and the negative affects coding for another. That's right. And so touching in and asking oneself, and then also just the quick coherence to put that mind.
Move it from here to here.
Yeah. 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 Beautiful. All right. Well, I am so glad that you were able to come and share all of your research and your wisdom with us today. And there's a lot going on at HeartMath, and I hope down the line we can get together again and learn about the new things that you're learning about. And
I'm sure we can. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Roland.
All right. Okay. Have a great day, everyone.
And thank you for those of you watching or listening. Thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we're here in community, exploring our common unity.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ celebrating his 90th birthday.